Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Friends, I'm so excited about this episode featuring all kinds of different takes on fantasy. And by fantasy, I mean sexual fantasies, fantasy fiction, fantasy role-playing games, psychoanalytic fantasies. I brought on esoteric scholar Peter Biebergall and countercultural pastor Barry Taylor to talk about all of this, on the uses of fantasy, the way fantasy breaks through into reality and gives it its contours. In some ways, of course, reality is just an aggregate of different sorts of fantasies. That's certainly what psychoanalysis indicates to us. But here, we will talk about the use of fantasy from all these different angles, and especially how it connects with art. In Barry's terms, it's fantasy as world navigating.
The surge of the fantastic in its various iterations is perhaps the way we're finding our way, into this liminal state in varying ways.
And Peter talks a lot about how fantasy leads us to creating meaningful art, and that meaningful art can be a sort of indicator as to whether or not the fantasies we're curating are worthwhile.
You know, let's just look at the history of art. The idea that socialist Mexicans, Muslims, are trying to come to the United States to, steal children I've never seen any good art come out of that. But I've seen a lot of good art come out of a belief in the Virgin Mary, whether it's true or not.
And as an extension of those, well, you may not be surprised to hear that I'm interested in fantasy as far as the uses of the pornographic and what that gives us that other kinds of fantasy intersections with art don't.
In pornography, people are like, wow, I really resonate. I project myself into what I see, and I also take it in and imagine it's happening in front of me, but it's also me, but it's not me, but it's me, but it's not me. One of the reasons why pornography has such a threatening presence to so many people is only because of what you're saying. It's not because of the pornography itself, it's because there are so few major options where you feel like you're transported into the work. When you watch Marvel movies, they're pure spectacle. Like, it's really a shame what, you used to watch a kung fu movie and you feel like you can do kung fu when you leave the movie. Yeah. But you watch Avengers and it's just this fucking thing happening in front of you that you can only witness it. And so I think, porn and horror movies to some extent as well, which are also a much beleaguered art form, they give us those feelings of being transported in and out of the art, like a kind of breathing.
To bring all of that together, I want to point to how fantasy becomes spectacle that only seems to involve us. I don't want to go down the excellent road founded by Guy Debord and the Society of the Spectacle and the Situationists here, although I think that would be fun too. I instead just want to reference comics and fiction writer Alan Moore, who points out that in the past decade, along with the rise of the superhero movie, we've also been subject to a proliferation of problems. Moore said that he had and has, and this is a quote, spotted serious and worrying implications for the future if millions of adults were queuing up to see Batman movies, because that kind of infantilization, that urge towards simpler times, simpler realities, that can very often be a precursor to fascism. So, if reality is an aggregate of fantasies, and some of those fantasies and the way they're expressed through art indicate danger, and if even objectivity is just another form of fantasy, what kinds of fantasies should we be curating? That's one question. And another is about how we enter into fantasy and engage with it once it's present. So to that end, on this episode, we talk a lot about Dungeons & Dragons and other role-playing games as a sort of training ground for the reality-making fantasies. D&D is obviously different than other sorts of games because the active imaginal process, that active imaginal process is also why, and we talk about this at length, there were huge fears that kids would get lost in their D&D campaigns and worlds during the Satanic Panic. Maybe the allure of other worlds and being involved in them would be too potent for kids to escape that temptation. But if that were true, why didn't anyone ask, what was it about this world that we wanted to leave or reshape or change with magic or force? Or just the companionship of a small band of brave friends journeying through the woods and the darkness together? I'm so happy to share this episode with you, friends. Against Everyone with Connor Beebe is brought to you by Patreon patrons. If you are one, hello. The reason why I don't have any ads is because this show is supported by its listeners. If that's you, if you're a listener and you don't support yet, I urge you to contribute to keep this adventure campaign going. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib. Please go there and support today. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib. You can then be a level 4 paladin or something. You know what I mean. All right, here we go.
Hi, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Beebe. I'm really excited to bring you together on the show, Peter Biebergall and Barry Taylor. Hi.
Hey, Connor.
Great to be here.
So I wanted to start by talking about art and fantasy. And to kick it off, I thought I'd quote the psychoanalytic philosopher Todd McGowan, who's been on the show twice, or not quote, paraphrase at least. And he said something like, you know, we need to take fantasy very seriously, and we need to understand that it's already at the center of our lives and the construction of reality, and therefore it deserves serious consideration. Now, obviously, from a psychoanalytic standpoint, this is completely true. Fantasies sort of run the show. But I think we consider fantasy in a lot of different ways, and we consider it also, you know, sexual fantasies, the kinds of fantasies that are sort of whimsy, and then also fantasy, fiction, and role-playing games. So I thought I would just roll that topic into the room and let you guys pick it up, and then we'll just run with that.
I'll start by saying I just finished reading, finally, for the first time, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And I would say, first of all, the last quarter of that book is some of the finest fantasy fiction I've ever read. And I think it allows me at least to think about the ways in which fantasy fiction is a way to express enchanted consciousness. And that's really what I've been most interested in lately, is thinking about both how we can have experiences that one might define as enchanted that aren't necessarily measurable or repeatable or in any way, that they sort of exist in an irrational way, but that we should embrace that without always having tried to define it or categorize it, and also how things like fiction, art, poetry, even music can reflect states of enchantment, either by virtue of the characters or the artist's own experiences. I think a lot of people there's a lot of work right now being done around really trying to take a new look at art history and to give more, to try to elevate where magic and the occult have played a role in art history, that tries to bring it back into the center as opposed to just being this fringy thing that some people were doing, or that they were necessarily by default outsider artists, or that term that people like to use, you know, when people seem to be pushing outside of what might be normative ideas about what the subjects or the methods of art.
I mean, it's fascinating to me to sort of consider in some ways how the notion of fantasy and making room for it has grown into the kind of broad mainstream culture. And the way that it's sort of gaining and garnering the attention of adults of all kinds and all different sort of realms, and challenged, I think, in many ways, how we not only think about fantasy, but also then how we feel about reality and what that may or may not be. And I can't help but think that in some ways, you know, it seems that it's developed along with like modern society, you know, from like Gothic literature all the way forward. You know, it's just grown and grown and grown, and like a snowball picked up all these different boulders that incorporate. So when we talk about fantasy, I mean, it becomes really this big umbrella under which lots and lots of different things live, which I think is really fascinating. And I think Peter's right about that whole idea that within things like art history, the kind of magical, fantastical becomes much more, much less marginalized, and taken much more seriously, I think, in lots of different circles, begrudgingly by some people, I think, but because it doesn't fit with, you know, the sort of rational, objective, critical approach to things. That's what I think is fascinating about fantasy, is it collapses that kind of reserved and removed objective look at things. If you do that, then you almost can't find your way into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really great if that objective sort of logical way of thinking was revealed by this move as another form of fantasy. I mean, that would be really great if, like, yeah. we got to the point where we realized that was a kind of, you know, that objectivity as we know it in this form, at least, because, you know, what objectivity is, it's changed over time, is, you know, kind of fetish objective or something like that. Like a fetish.
Yeah.
Objective.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, probably to go back to McGowan's sort of psychoanalytic notion and you know, what you intimated about fantasy being at the center. I mean, reality really is a sort of fantastical construct around which we build our lives to, you know, somehow in some ways, I think, just to hold on. But
right. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's just to go back to something else Todd has said. And he's just such a clear guide in the realm of psychoanalysis. So that's why I'm quoting him again. But he says something like, you know, before Freud, we would think that we were subjects of knowledge. That is, we would learn things and then we would learn new things, and the new things would overturn the old things. But Freud discovered that we are subjects of desire, and that our desires and what we want and what, you know, we are drawn to but pretend to not want, and that sort of thing. That's actually what makes the world kind of go round. But I think it was really interesting to bring this question to you guys because, you know, Barry, doing all your work with theology, and you know, Peter, really, you do work with theology in a different sort of roundabout way almost, which is interesting.
I mean, it is my background too, which is interesting because it's...
Yeah, there you go.
it always asserts itself in some form.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess for me, it's like looking at the ways that fantasy overtakes and then becomes the real. You know, that big scare of Dungeons and Dragons warping kids' minds and driving them crazy, you know, as part of Satanic Panic, but also just as its own sort of thing with, you know, mazes and monsters and this sort of thing where you would think that you were locked into the game. And I mean, in some ways, I feel like that's true. In some ways, I feel like that's some sort of weird mini mirror on how fantasy becomes the real. And so I thought maybe we could talk about that a little bit when it breaks through.
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing a lot of thinking about that. I'm actually, my friend, Gareth Branwyn, you might know, he's a big part of the cyberpunk and maker community. writer, critic. He writes a lot for Boing Boing and has been part of that sort of zine scene for a very long time. In any case, he and I have been working on some material related to in what ways are the aspects of consciousness that we enter into when we play role-playing games, in what ways are those the same modes of consciousness when one is, say, doing acts of divination or ceremonial magic? Let's say you're using a divination system. You've, in that moment, have to enter into a way of thinking. It's not about suspension of disbelief. I've kind of decided that I don't think that captures anything anymore. When somebody's, say, performing an act of divination, they have to have exchanged an idea of chance to actually be an idea of the fates or the gods or whatever, right? You have to change what's actually happening. We have to have a completely new understanding. And I actually think you're actually entering into a different state of consciousness when you've decided that when you pick a card from a tarot deck or when you roll coins for I Ching, that it's not chance, it's something else. Maybe it's synchronicities, maybe it's, like I said, the fates, maybe it's your god or goddess, whatever it is. And when we play role-playing games, something similar is happening because we are taking on the likeness of a character. So we've already entered into a space where we're inhabiting a different consciousness. And it's not to say that you're not inside and outside of it all the time. I mean, that's one of the neat things, right? It's always this back and forth because you can make your jokes while you're eating Cheetos, but split second later, you're back inhabiting the character. And nothing is diminished, I don't think, the ability to do that. But when you come up against something in a game, say, and you are required to roll the dice, now your choices or how you respond is now governed by those dice. It's more than chance. It's actually divining the course of the narrative of the game. Mm. And it forces you as a character to have to respond in kind to that. I mean, you could go so far as to say that any form of game playing that involves chance is also requires us to take on this kind of divinatory mindset or consciousness, even Monopoly, because you are then required, your choices are then governed by this microcosm of the game, right? That has its own cosmological laws around what can happen and what your choices are. But role-playing games, I think in particular, allow a much more fluid and interesting way to think about chance becoming divinatory and what that does to our consciousness. And so, yes, there is something true about when we enter into that space, it's not just frivolity, that there's something else taking place that I think is special.
It occurred to me when you brought up the Dungeons and Dragons thing, because I remember where, you know, I was quite active in sort of church circles when all that madness was going on, and I find, you know, when I listen to the sort of political conspiracy theorists around the election, you know, they've got their own sort of satanic panic going, and the dungeon is now in that pizza parlor in Washington, you Absolutely. Know, and all the dragons are, you know, this gang of whoever they are, you know, Hollywood elites and
ultimately Jews.
But I do wonder if all these things like fantasy and the way that we are looking at things like chance and stuff like that, if that isn't all in many ways part of a growing shift in the way that we're even thinking these days about not just the nature of reality, but of consciousness, what it means to be, awake and alive in the world, how we understand the way things work. I mean, we sort of come off the back of a long period in the West where kind of esoteric thought, you know, occult thinking or whatever, even to some degree, general religious thinking has again shifted its place in the conversation, because we were driven by such ideas around, you know, scientific rationalism and logic. So the idea of our realities thus far have been framed by our need to sort of control outcomes. So things like luck and chance are words and ideas that we don't want to let loose, really. I mean, I can remember hearing any number of sermons where, you know, people would say, oh, yeah, well, you know, there's no such thing as luck with God. And I'm like, well, have you not read the Old Testament then? You know, or have you not read Ecclesiastes? Or have you not, you know, what about the witches of Endor? You know, I mean, there are so many instances where you can actually make a case that a different approach to the whole idea of reality and how you enter into things plays out in those realms. But we didn't want to look, because we reduced faith down to the logic of doctrinal, dogmatic, creedal assertions, rather than diving into, I don't know what we even dive into.
But that's even what conspiracy theorists are doing, right? It's dogmatizing something that is just a thought form, right? Yeah. Or an idea that then, I'm always reminded of, in Umberto Eco's novel, Foucault's Pendulum, there's a character when talking about, you know, this vast conspiracy theory that is supposedly being constructed. He says, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, you know, the folly is we keep trying to make metaphysics mechanics. If you don't mind, I'll just tell you a quick story. There's a friend of mine, a family friend, who's a devout atheist. Has no interest in even talking about religion culturally as a whatever. Like, it's just, he's not interested. And I was once on Facebook, after my book Strange Frequencies came out, I was commenting about how it was funny that I was getting a lot of requests to get on these podcasts that when I would look into them, they would be these right-leaning conspiracy theory things, which is just not anything I'm interested in or would participate in. And I thought it was interesting that they hadn't read my work, or they would know I really wasn't the right candidate for these kind of shows. I had posted this, and this fellow responded. He said, "Well, see, I've been telling you this. This is what religion is. It's all the same. It's all this." And I said, "Well, you know, let's just look at the history of art. The idea that socialist Mexicans, Muslims are trying to make or come to the United States to, you know, steal children, has never, I've never seen any good art come out of that. But I've seen a lot of good art come out of a belief in the Virgin Mary, whether it's true or not, right? Like, let's really just break down what kinds of things were beliefs we're talking about." And he wasn't having any of it. And I finally realized, I said, if you don't think that there's a difference between, you know, the pizza shop conspiracy theory about satanic pedophiles and John Coltrane's Love Supreme, then we're not even talking about the same things. This conversation, like, we're not even using the same categories. We're not using the same language at all. So that's why, for when talking about this, I do want to make a distinction between different kinds of fantasies, different, and the ways in which those, what those do to us and how they resolve themselves. Do they resolve themselves in an attack on the Capitol in the States, or do they resolve themselves in Love Supreme, right? I mean, that's, for me, I think, is something that we can measure and can try to create at least some shared language around, some grammar to make sense of that.
Just to sort of bring something you and Barry said together, Peter. It's like, when I decide to play a role-playing game and I decide that I'm going to control the chance by rolling the dice, this is a really weird idea. Like, of course, the person who wrote the adventure, or if you're using a module or something like that, who wrote the campaign, like, they've set up certain encounters for you where it's more likely that you're going to bring the dice into play. But a lot of times you can do things when you're playing that you're like, I'm going to do this. Let's roll the dice and see how it turns out. So you decide to introduce the chance. And I found that really fascinating, because chance is a signal that we have freedom. So, you know, if there's no chance, at least on this sort of plane where we can see things, if there's no, you know, chance or chaos or randomness, then we can't really have freedom. They're very deeply dependent on each other, because we need to be able to make choices. And so that means that there's a sort of break or a hole in the deterministic environment. And that means that chance is possible and things can go sort of any way. But then I think about, you know, I saw the great fiction writer Jennifer Egan read from her latest novel, and she was talking about watching her kids play Dungeons and Dragons. She has one kid who is like really into baseball and like was just talking about numbers and stats and all that. And she sat down with him and he basically told her a whole story about these players' lives through talking about numbers. And she was like, it was really touching. And she said, and then when I watched my other child who plays Dungeons and Dragons a lot, I saw how much of it was about numbers. Like, people talk about it as a story thing, but so much of it is actually an immersion in the play of numbers. And that was really striking to her. That yet we think of numbers as being, although, you know, there's a total abstraction, mathematics is in some ways a total abstraction, it also feels like the most determined thing in the world. And so the idea that we would, you know, get into this weird play between chance and directive. What can I direct? What do I direct into chance? What happens chaotically? No pun intended for the point of talking about Dungeons and Dragons. What happens chaotically? What happens lawfully? You know, how do these things show up? That interplay is a really interesting way to talk about what's fantasy and what's reality as well. Now, when you're talking about the kinds of art that sort of unfurl into these different forms, I think that's something I really wanted to talk with you guys about, which was curating fantasy. You know, I mean, we need people who can distinguish between different kinds of fantasy sets and say what's useful or good or interesting or beautiful or destructive in all of them, and what we can use. You know, Barry, you do collage all the time, and you wrote about bricolage and collage and assemblage. And if anybody goes to Barry's Instagram, there's always a different collage almost every day that you've done. And so you have this idea of, you know, assembling and kind of curating image and bringing it together into a new form. And I think that's, you know, a particular skill, that's that kind of collaging is the artistic version of a skill that's needed socially as well. There's that story by Donald Barthelme called The Genius. And there's a line in it, what's like, what do you consider the most important tool of genius today? And the genius says rubber cement, meaning the ability to paste things on, you know, in this collage. And so I think that it is a kind of genius to be able to pick out which images that we didn't think could go together would go together, which things are valuable to include in the picture. And so, yeah, I mean, that's all a long way of saying, I do want to talk about curating fantasy as well, because some are, I don't want to say better than others, although I would feel comfortable saying that, but that's not exactly where I want to go. Some give us something and others give us another thing.
I mean, God, there are so many directions to go with, I mean, because even when you were talking about the story of the kid with the baseball stats, all I could think of was like all the people that sit around, you know, inventing their fantasy baseball teams or football teams or whatever, you know, that marriage of, you know, the statistical with fantasy. So, which comes back to my sort of earlier point that in some ways fantasy is so central to our everyday sort of lived experience now. We just don't probably think about its impact on us. But I think, again, we've sort of lived in this era where we've been exposed already to lots of, you know, I mean, if you've been to any number of rock concerts, you've been exposed to kind of some kind of fantasy event, and you think about the elaborate nature of the way that something like a rock show is constructed these days, where in some way, because quite often the size of the event, it's not enough that you have the band, they have to be surrounded with this other larger picture of who and what they are, or what they want you to feel or see. You know, I'm quite slow with things, and it took me a long time to realize that my sort of daily collage was actually a kind of sign of how I've lived my existence, which is actually taking all these various bits and going, you know, that's going to kind of work with that, you know, idea wise, you know, conceptually and stuff. But it took me such a long time to realize that that wasn't something that I did on the side. It was actually a kind of visual reflection of an approach to life. And again, I think it's interesting that, it seems to be one of the main visual expressions on Instagram. I mean, there are so many people doing collages, and it's very interesting to see what people put out there in terms of how they manifest this stuff. And you can see you can sort of read in some ways where people are coming from with how they handle what they handle, you know, the sort of level of control is the wrong word, but focus and stuff like that. I'm not sure what I'm saying here. I'm just it feels like we're getting towards something. No, you know, that we're working on.
It makes me wonder, just as an aside thought, that as more and more properties that are extremely popular, say, come into the public domain, and artists have access to be able to remix, collage them, take them apart, put them back together. What's the next generation of that going to look like when they can be completely dismantling? I mean, at some point, Tolkien's going to end up in the public domain. I mean, what is that going to look like, you know?
Yeah, I mean, those things are interesting, and it's interesting the copyright fight that goes on, you know what I mean? And this idea that somebody came up with that idea independently, you know, that this kind of modern idea of the genius is this person that kind of works alone and their ideas just sort of descend out of the clouds, rather than, you know, the ancient idea of the genius is something that sort of came to you and works with you and gifts you something, rather than, you know, you're not a genius, you have a genius, you know. And there's,
it's usually responsive to something that came before too, so yeah, it's always in it's always drawing from, it's usually not in a vacuum either, you know.
Yeah, and you have these arguments over, well, you know, you stole my song, you know. And it's like, well, how, you know, there are only, I mean, if you know three chords, you can play almost every song in the pop songbook, pretty much, because I mean, there are only so many chords that we play in Western music, and so it's really hard not to step on somebody else's toes. But we've got this kind of idea that we can own this territory.
If I'm thinking of you know, the Winnie the Pooh horror movie that just came out. Do you guys know about that? It's like, because Winnie the Pooh came into public domain, so someone made it into a horror movie immediately. Yeah. And it's fine. It's like, you know, whatever. This is a kind of a silly idea. But then I'm thinking about, and that makes things seem sort of limited. It's like Winnie the Pooh, but horror, you know, whatever. But then I think about, you know, the sexual act. And the sexual act is like, in some ways, actually kind of very limited. One of my Patreon patrons, I forget exactly who it is, so whoever you are, thank you. But he said, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I play the same video game over. It's like I have these like 7 buttons, you know, and I can push them in all these different combinations and all these different things can happen. And like it lasts a really long time to be able to use those 7 buttons. And in some ways, the sexual act is like that. If you think about it, it becomes essentially, or feels essentially limited in what you can do. And yet there's also infinite variety. But that even weirder than that, I think, is that if you sort of take a Freudian position or something like that, you can say, well, everything's sexual. So therefore, I'm actually going to look for the sexual in conversation or in cooking or in walking down the street or in reading a book. Like, what in there is actually emanating from the sexual? And so in that way, where you say, I'm going to take this as the lens on the world rather than I'm just going to reconfigure, you also get something, you know, else entirely. It widens the scope of it. Yeah. So I think, you know, when we look at fantasy, you know, I mean, we have so many novels, and we can say that maybe it starts with and was never really surpassed by Ulysses by James Joyce, where it's like, well, the everyday is actually a mythic epic adventure that is, you know, would put the gods to shame, just walking down the street one day and the people you meet, if you really examine that experience. So I'm also just sort of interested in that, like when the lens overtakes the sort of, instead of it becoming an item that you recombinate with something else, but rather actually envelops the whole way of seeing. And that doesn't happen. I mean, that doesn't happen that much. I mean, yeah, we have the Bible, you know, for we have Freud, we have a certain scientific, you know, invention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think I think you're right. There's a big, you know, so Winnie the Pooh is a horror film. You could call it a remix. You can call it maybe a reconfiguration, but really it's a remix, because not much has really changed. I think what you're talking about is more of a sort of recapitulation, where you actually get something novel, not novel in the kind of philosophical sense, where something actually other or different has emerged and been offered. And I think that is a much rarer commodity, and something that probably needs to be striven after a lot more. Striven, is that good? Is that the right? Can you work out what the tense strived after? I'll go.
As you put it out there, somebody then is going to use their particular lens to, right? So it's very hard for it to just exist.
Yeah, absolutely. And perhaps it. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Connor mentioned the Bible, so you know it gets put out there, and everybody you know asserts their view on it, or Freud, you know what I mean. Everybody's got their angle, but there was within that was something, you know. So Freud gives us this idea of the unconscious and the role of desire, and now we remix and reconfigure those notions, but they were given. I think, I don't know, isn't that what you're trying to say, Connor, that to some degree there's a lot of low level, if you like, fantasy?
Yeah. I think I'm thinking about the fantasies. I mean, maybe people would object to me using the term fantasy. Maybe I would object to that, but when the fantasy becomes a lens rather than a component that you can collage into something, but in fact you begin to see that way. Like when I was making movies, I mean, I definitely used sex as my lens to view everything. And it was a fine way to do it. I mean, I think it was fine. It was an interesting way to walk through the world for 10 years, to see things through that aspect of the imagination that is undeniably pornographic. It's why I always think people want to ban pornography. I'm like, well, good luck, because that's how people think, that imagination is completely pornographic. So I don't know what you're going to do about that. But like, accessing that as my sort of lens of looking at things, it might sound quite vulgar to some people, but it actually revealed a lot of beautiful, you know, things about the world to me, and very interesting things about the world to me. But then I'm sort of thinking, you know, yeah, some people, you know, I mean, Barry, you certainly know, and I'm sure Peter, you too, the people that, you know, they're like washing the dishes and they're like, dear Jesus, please let me wash these dishes with, like, you know, in your name, dear Lord, you know what I mean? Like, the most everyday things become infused with a certain kind of Christianity. Or, you know, I think that there's, it's not just some person who's like, maybe my own example was bad before, because I'm not just talking about one person doing it, but it becomes a sort of world enveloping fantasy. Yeah. I'm just confused.
So, like, if I were using the word fantasy in that regard. Because I mean, I think that there's the colloquial fantasy, which means untrue. And I don't want that, to me is absolutely not the same as,
right, definitely,
fantastical landscapes of thought, whatever they might be.
Right.
And that could be something very simple. You know, it doesn't have to be outlandish. It's just, so it's not that I want to, because I think when you use it to say, talk about the person who's washing the dishes, it sounds like you're applying, and you may not be, I'm just saying, that sounds to me like you're applying a measure of true or false to that worldview.
I'm not. I mean, especially not for the person that's doing that. I mean, yeah. What am I going to say to that?
I think what you're saying is that there are immersive fantasies, mm-hmm. if you like. There are things that occur, and people immerse themselves in it so much so that their everyday life gets soaked in whatever that, you know, I mean, and I you know, fantasy, when you're talking about religion and stuff like that, you know, can be upsetting to people. But I think, you know, those ideas that we get immersed in, I think that's what you're trying to say, right, Connor?
Yeah, and I think that there's some virtue perhaps in being able to traverse the immersive landscapes of different kinds of, you know, or the landscapes of different kinds of immersive fantasies.
Yeah, you know, and I think what you're hoping for, or searching for perhaps, or pointing towards, is who's the guy that had the quantified fantasy in those categories? I can't, you know, because he talked about the portal and the immersive, and the liminal. I can't remember what the fourth one is, but he talks about the liminal fantasy, you know, that takes you to the edge.
Rhetorics of Fantasy, Farrah Mendelssohn?
I think it is, yeah. I think
four types of fantasy: portal quest, immersive, intrusion, and liminal. So like the portal quest would be like Narnia.
Sure. So you go through a door into something. But I think what I sense that Connor was pulling at is how we distinguish and look for those liminal, what I guess Mendelssohn would call, now we know his name, would call the kind of liminal fantasy, you know, where we kind of find ourselves on the edge of another way, another world, another way of thinking, another way of being, another way of understanding the world around us. And I think there's something interesting about sort of breaking them down, as Connor said, yeah. You know, the different kinds of fantasies, because you can't, again, it's an umbrella where lots of things live. It seems to me that we're quite good with the immersive fantasy, you know, sinking our teeth into something and letting it permeate and stuff. The liminal ones, the ones that bring us to the edge of our known worlds, those are always troublesome because those invite risk. And it's funny, you know, that in some ways at the heart of a lot of fantasy is this idea of risk and adventure, but when we're invited to to embark on a journey of risk and adventure, it's, you know, outside the outside the realm of a game or, you know, a board or a system, it becomes a whole different equation. But again, I think I'm inclined to say that I feel that given the what seems to be the collapsing or the imploding of many of our supportive structures within our various societies in the last 40 or 50 years, that the surge of the fantastic in its various iterations is perhaps the way we're finding our way, you know, into this liminal state in our various in varying ways.
And this is probably too big of a conversation to really start, but just to at least point it out, the question of the value or risk of, say, psychedelics, right, as methods for getting us to the thresholds, how are they valuable? Are they, you know, I know people of every stripe that have varying degrees of quote success. Mm-hmm. I know a fellow whose life is in chaos and every year goes to his ayahuasca retreat. Mm-hmm. But his life doesn't change as a result, right? Ultimately, I mean, there's that, you know, so we're brought to these thresholds, and then, you know, there was always that question that, Houston Smith talking about, you know, what happens when we're brought to the threshold. He's saying in the case of, say, drug use of LSD, if at the other side of that is then not a furthering of an ethical, life, if it's just a continuing bumping up against it, just being brought and coming back and brought and coming back, but your personhood is not transformed by it in any way. And that for me is always the measure of any of these, you know, in terms of any practice or fantasy or anything we're talking about, if it doesn't in some way bend you more, say, towards kindness, then that for me is sort of what you're talking about, Connor, like ones that we feel are useful or could be you know, how do we judge that? I have my own set of criteria for that, like I said, and for me it's it's kindness and beauty, whatever, you know, very subjective terms, but you know, I think we can tell the difference between kindness and meanness in a general sense. We keep finding ourselves there by these different means, methods, things that happen to us, things that we create. But is there the possibility for a real personal, cultural, social transformation that, again, I think for me, you know, being, kindness, I think is just such an important thing for me to want to say out loud.
Just to pick that up, I mean, I've been talking a bit on the show lately about my issues with magic and, you know, with the K, for lack of better way to distinguish, and psychedelics. And my problems with them, I mean, I think the thing with, to situate in this conversation, I would say it's important to know what quest we're on before we decide to reach for, you know, how we're going to develop and what kind of kindness we're going, what kind of kindness we're going to develop and where we're going. I mean, I think for me, the the quest that we're on, you know, moving towards non-materialism, not dialectical materialism, not a sort of nuanced integral studies, spiral dynamics, systems theory kind of materialism, but actual non-materialism. And what does that mean? What does that look like? And when we take psychedelics, my issue with that always is, you know, those operate through, those are spiritual experiences that operate through the physical response of our organs. And they've also been used for a really long time. So the beings that we meet there and the entities and presences that we meet by doing these have been met by tons of people that shouldn't have met them. And that's changed what they are over time. And what we have access to in the pathway has changed over time. Now, this is why I think it's, you know, unfortunate that, you know, Graham Hancock has this show now where he's telling everybody to do psychedelics and everybody should try them at least once or whatever. I mean, it's great for him because he had migraines. So he did ayahuasca to stop getting migraines every 3 months. But like, I think the idea that somehow that's going to bring us to a spiritual experience rather than just a kind of astral, spiritual looking experience of our own physical anatomy and is a problem. And I think the same thing with magic, where people are reaching into the spiritual world to command things to do stuff in the physical world without any self-development. I mean, I even think New Age and self-help stuff is way better than doing magic or psychedelics, because at least there's a self-improvement component to a lot of it and a self-development component to a lot of it. But I think that when we realize that we're on a certain kind of quest, then, which for me is this specific one, you know, then I think we run into problems with doing these, even if they do make us kind. Because we can be kind and trapped in a reality that we're not meant to be in anymore. And it's good, it's better for us to be kind, but it might not be enough to get us out of the level where unkindness is completely proliferating, even if we're being nice to other people or being kind to other people. The way that we approach that might be enhancing a sort of, you know, violence and, you know, non-compassion.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really good point, yeah.
Confession, I did a lot of acid when I was young. you know, I sort of came of age in the 70s. So, you know, post-hippie culture, but still when, you know, drugs were a big part of my youth, because I just bypassed beer and went straight to speed and acid and stuff like that. And I think, and then, you know, the whole psychedelic world kind of sort of evaporated, you know, disappeared from the edge, and went to the margins of sort of popular culture for a good like 30 years or so. And now it's made this comeback. And of course, you know, when things return, they never return in the same form. So it's sort of the whole psychedelic movement, I think, is split up into the one side where you have the associations with things like ayahuasca and the journeys and
the DMT entity. Yeah.
The transformational moment, and then you have the larger kind of almost medicinal use of
microdosing,
you know, to deal with
work for trauma, PTSD. There's work being done with that,
and for those culturally induced existential issues, you know, trauma, PTSD, you know, anxiety, fear of death and stuff like that. And it's interesting because, you know, when I was taking a lot of acid, the conversation was singular, and it was all, I mean, I didn't really sort of buy into it. I was taking it for my own reasons, but the larger sort of cultural conversation was all about, you know, oh, you take LSD, you know, you take speed because you're going to dance all night, but you take LSD because you want to see God or, you know, whatever. And now we have this bifurcated conversation where it's either you're going to see God or have your transformational experience, or you're going to get, or you're going to get, you know, you're going to manage your anxiety through it. And we kind of have a pronged path of this. All I can say is that the one thing that psychedelics can teach anybody who takes them, forget what happens within with the experience or where you're going with it or what you're trying to do. Psychedelics collapse your understanding of the nature of reality, because suddenly what was concrete becomes, you know, you put your hand through your own body and, you know, you have all those experiences. And I do think that in some sense, it represents yet one more of these shifts within our culture, where whatever we've been experiencing as reality is not sufficient for more and more people, and so I think it I agree with you. I find it a little worrying on both sides. You know, like running off somewhere for your ayahuasca. Although again, I will say that, you know, I did psychoanalysis for some time as well, and when it was over, I sort of didn't know if it had done me any good for a while.
Yeah.
Until I realized that I actually had changed in a sense, but it wasn't the changes that I expected. Because I expected I expected to be a different person.
Yeah.
I wasn't a different person. I'm the same.
We call that the educational variety of the spiritual experience.
And it's like, it reminds me a little bit of, I'm a big fan of Adam Phillips, you know, and he brought out two books last year. And the first one was called On Wanting to Change. And it was about, you know, our cultural desire both to change and also to get better. And the question that he asked is, well, what is it we want to change? And why do we think that's the thing that needs to be changed? And what is it that we think getting better looks like? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do wonder that we're running, and I think this comes to both your points, we're running towards psychedelics and things in the hope of change without considering actually what the change is.
Right.
Because usually we just want to be freed from something that we think that's shackling us. And it's probably, you know, and to go back to your quotes from McGowan or from Freud or from any other psychoanalyst about desire and what we want and what we don't want, what we usually want to be freed from at best is a symptom. And in a sense, it's probably not the thing that's holding it, that's shackling us down in the first place. And maybe
we get stuck in the symptom.
Yeah,
we think that is the thing, but there's usually, you know, it's usually maybe, the symptom by virtue of its what that means. Yeah,
and maybe this proliferation of fantasy is just this growing desire to unlock this. And what we need, to come back to your point, Connor, is to consider in what way these fantasies can be strange to say organized, but curated to take us, and that I don't think that's the mystery and the dilemma with the whole conversation, really. It's not that there's a lack of fantasy out there, it's what it's going towards, where, you know, where we feel.
It's beautifully said, because I think like you can view also the reaching for psychedelics to solve problems as a symptom, like rather than, oh, this is treatment or this is medicine, I'm actually just experiencing another symptom. And it, like, just, I'm glad you brought up AA, Peter, because I'm also thinking about how, you know, I mean, I'm not an addict, so, but I've gone to Al-Anon meetings and I've gone to plenty of AA meetings with former partners. So what I see happening there is something quite different. It's a quite different kind of medicine. And it's different internally than it is from looking from the outside. Before I went to those AA meetings with someone else and went to the Al-Anon meetings, I was like, oh, well, AA doesn't work. You know, this like bullshit thing that people say when they're on the outside, because they're like, well, so-and-so, sure, he was sober for 10 years, but then he drank again or he did drugs right. again or whatever. Yeah. But when you're in it, you see that what's actually happening is that people are congregating. They're speaking their symptoms out loud in front of others that share overlapping symptoms. They're deciding not to, at least out loud, judge each other. I'm sure there's a lot of gossip when you leave the meeting sometimes, but they're deciding not to judge each other, even in things that are sometimes quite terrible and quite intense. They're actually just holding the space with each other. And then it's like, in the same way, it holds the addiction. So like when someone doesn't drink for 5 years and then they drink again, it's like, well, that doesn't mean it doesn't work. That means that the relapse or whatever is being cradled by something that can hold it, that can actually hold the person in place so that they have somewhere else to go back into the reflective and healing process.
Yes. And it's a paradox of AA. And I could say for myself, just to out myself as somebody who's in recovery, that personally, what I needed from a very young age was the kind of thing that can be found in AA, can certainly be found in other places, but can be found in AA. The problem is that I had to almost die to be able to get it. So it's sort of like, I don't know what would have happened to me if I never drank or took drugs. That may not have been good either, because the only solution for me ultimately to become the kind of person that I want to be was found within that kind of understanding of what was going on with me. But to get there required basically having to die, you know, like it's like the, and not everybody, well, some people do, right? And then they don't get that. And, you know, just to go back to this notion of psychedelics too, which is very interesting for my generation and maybe kind of for yours as well, is that we had neither we only had the dregs of the spiritual elements of LSD and psychedelics. Mm-hmm. Nobody was talking about medicinal things at all. And so our LSD experiences were these furtive behind the suburban mall, yeah, you know, and it was, and the drug itself wasn't very clean. And so it was this wired, fighting to keep it together for 7 hours, you know,
drinking orange juice. Yeah.
Right. But still believing, at least for myself, that I convinced myself that on the other side of that was some perfected spiritual self. And I think that, and so the quest for that then drove me, you know, to futilely doing this over and over and over again, you know, in the hopes that, because I still knew the literature, right? I read the psychedelic experience and I was completely, possessed when I was 16 years old by Carlos Castaneda's writing, you know, mm-hmm. And think, you know, so, and that kind of magical thinking, that's a particular kind of fantasy too, that I think gets bound up in all of this. And then letting go of that, you know, and trying to construct, like, how do you replace, you know, it's like if what we're doing is replacing fantasies, you know, with others, whatever they may be, if we're using fantasy sort of in this broader way, kind of that you sort of set out for us, how do we become more, how do we do that? I think this idea of collage is exactly right, because we have to be able to step back and look at all the different elements, right? Because when you're so inside of it, like drug addiction, when you're so inside of that insidious fantasy, it doesn't, there's nothing anybody can say. There's no secret key or word. I don't even, know why it changes for some and doesn't change for others. But we might ask that of somebody who's enveloped with, say, QAnon right now. And, when you're inside of that, it absolutely makes sense. The world absolutely makes sense, understanding it through this thing, even though you can see at some level that there is something that's destructive or hurtful, or, I could see the damage I was doing to myself and the people around me, but that promise of the other side of some perfected reality is very, very difficult to overcome, no matter what the state of your situation is.
Yeah, well, that's probably the ultimate fantasy of human existence, or at least in our time, this notion that there's a perfect you out there somewhere, and that your quest is to sort of locate that person, and exchange, I mean, it's the fantasy that drives kind of a particular form of Christianity, it, particularly in the sort of 20th century and 21st now, this idea of, exchanging your dirty, sinful life for this, this perfect existence. But
it's still a Faustian bargain, however.
But I mean, the real fantasies are the ones that we've built our world on. Those are the real, the real fantasies, the systems, I think, and the way we think about. I can't help but think that I don't know why I feel so positive about all this, but I can't help but think on some level that all of these things are sort of a yearning and a reaching something important. And I think the arts have always been at least portals.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought it back to art. I really wanted to make sure that we
let me take it to art in 1 second. I just want to respond to everything you guys just said, and then I'll nudge it there. But I mean, I think, look, it's not a perfect self, but we can say in some way that our inner self is never suffering, that there is an aspect of us that doesn't play in that field of suffering and right and wrong and pain. But that might not be that the idea of reaching for that seems weird for me, in the sense that it's already there. We don't need to do that. Like, we have that, we are that. Like, actually, what's given to us is the opportunity of spiritual development, which is, and to a lesser degree, self-development, which is the sort of, like Freud's, was his grandson throwing the wheel and then coming back and throwing it and coming back. Like, we get to throw ourselves into it and come back, and throw ourselves into it and come back. But we don't need to establish a perfect self. It's there already. And actually, you lose it as soon as you start trying to develop it. But then I think, when I'm thinking about your AA experience, and this, it seems just karmic to me, right? Like, I know someone who's done heroin like 2 times and then never did it again, right? And then I know someone who did help people get off of heroin with Iboga, which is an intense experience, and some of those people just didn't work for. So it's like, that seems karmic to me, that it should intersect with your individuality addiction in that certain way. But what I hear when you're talking, Peter, is like, I needed a cosmic death initiation into a congregation of love.
Beautiful.
And so it's like, that's profound. And that's very different than doing a psychedelic to say, well, I'm going to have a death experience. I'm going to go and I'm going to do this crazy thing that alters my vision of reality and have this kind of death to materialism and then come back, because, you can't rely on that spiritual substance to be with you all the time. We actually talked about this last time on the show. I was just listening to it, the difference between spiritual state and substance. You can't get into the spiritual state and bring the substance back all the time. It just doesn't work. So like, that's why people, as you're saying, Barry, it's like, you know, they'll have this LSD trip and then they'll just, okay, well, you know, here I am again, better do it again, you know, better keep doing it. But then I also think about how I did LSD in that kind of like, yeah, like in the stairwell behind the apartment that my 19-year-old friend just got after high school, you know, and like feeling like shit. It's like, you know, oh, it's laced with arsenic, having these dumb visions. And then when I was older, I did mushrooms, and that was the spiritual quest. Like that was the spiritual journey versus the LSD. And I'm noticing like, well, that was my directive. My idea there was, oh, I'm taking like the organic plant thing, you know, so therefore, and there is a difference between them. It's not to say there's no actual difference, but
I think there is, yeah.
I know that my path was, you know, really informed by a certain decision that I made on viewing the substance that I was about to take as well. And that brings me back to the directive and chance thing, of the deciding to throw a kind of randomness into the worldview that I already have, or into the things that I've already decided on, all that kind of stuff. It's so interesting to me. So art.
Can I just say really quickly, I do think that how the language that frames these things has a lot to say as to how they're experienced. And so, you know, the broad conversation, the generic conversation about these things dictates, and what doesn't dictate, but at least sends people down, you know, with particular expectancies. And you kind of have to drown out that, I think, if you really want to have your own encounter with those things. The other thing, this is probably something to talk about on another occasion, not even necessarily on a podcast, but because this idea you brought up of like the sort of spiritual self, I struggle with that notion, even though I've spent my entire adult life thinking through, you know, sort of spirituality and theology and stuff like that. But that whole world is I have deep ambivalence about how we talk about the self. But anyway, let's talk about art. I just had to get that off my chest because, you know.
Okay, art. So, so we talked about people getting, you know, absorbed into art or fantasy landscapes or whatever. But I'm also thinking about the ways in which art breaks through into the real in kinds of confusions about what's real or not. So Lovecraft has come up on the show a bunch of times. You live in Lovecraft territory pretty much, you know. Yeah. The idea that this university is real, that the Necronomicon is real, that these gods are actually got, you know, that some of this stuff, and then you have people worshiping these beings now and creating religious rites and rituals around them. And I wanted to talk about, that's a particularly bleak version of art, you know, puncturing the real and people's consciousness in this Borgesian, you know, Tlon way. But is there a positive version of that is what I'm wondering.
Well, yeah. And it's actually, I was just reading a lot about like the Esoteric Order of Dagon, which was these group of chaos magicians in the 90s that, this whole thing that Lovecraft was, he was dreaming what was real, but he himself couldn't accept it because of his scared materialism. You know, he was too weak-willed to accept the reality of these deities and their bringing them on.
He wasn't Lovecraftian enough.
Lovecraft was not Lovecraftian enough, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that it does seem that the most times we see that bleed in, you know, tends to be, in his other examples, of, you know, esoteric thought that tends to have some very dark qualities to it, that tend to be the ones that sort of make their way through. I mean, I guess there's sort of the very innocuous things like people who believe in the force and, you know, have force, you know, religions around that, or people who have taught themselves Elvish or Klingon, or, you know, and those have become real identities for people. Like, they're not just, it's not just play. It seems to be in another, there does seem to be a change in consciousness that's happening there. Right. So I think that that's one way to think about it. I think for me, though, I think it's what I would like to say, though, about art and fantasy, though, is for me, it has to do with the ways in which it can. Do you remember? It's something that I think we've lost, or maybe I know that I've lost as somebody who's 55 years old. And remember reading when you were 15, 16, 17 years old, and maybe even into your early 20s, where every single thing you read was about you and the answer and perfect and enlivening and inspiring. And there was really like a sense of, you know, it, like, we decoupled from the real, you know, as we entered into it. And it could have been anything. I mean, for me, it was anything. And the same way, you know, music can do that and art can do that, I think, when you're young. And I don't know, I feel like I read so much more. It doesn't bleed through in the same way that it used to, in terms of really feeling something that, you know, it's a little bit, it was obviously very solipsistic when you're a young person, right? But it's a special way of reading a fantasy novel and somehow being able to identify in some fundamental way with a pain that the hero is feeling, or a longing that somebody's feeling, or I mean, I could do it when I was a kid with a top 40 pop song, but even more when it was something, you know, like a grand fantasy novel, right? And it's not like thinking I am, you know, this hero, but rather that something about their experience, you never could believe that somebody could so have perfectly captured what you're feeling at that time, you know? And I miss that experience, you know? Yeah. And I wonder if some of those fantasies that we have already named as being a little bit maybe darker, like, you know, the ping pong pizza conspiracy, if for those people, it is doing that same work on them, you know, that I feel like I've lost it in some ways, you know, as I've gotten older.
Yeah. Sorry. I just wanted to make this point as you were talking, because it is so, like, one of the places where that's present for people definitely is in pornography. It's still definitely there, where people are like, wow, I really resonate. I project myself into what I see, and I also take it in and imagine it's happening in front of me, but it's also me, but it's not me, but it's me, but it's not me, you know? And I think one of the reasons why pornography has such a threatening presence to so many people is only because of what you're saying. It's not because the pornography itself, is because there are so few major, you know, options where you feel like you're transported into the work. When you watch Marvel movies, they're pure spectacle. Like, it's really a shame, what, you know, you used to watch a kung fu movie and you feel like you can do kung fu when you leave the movie. Yeah. But you watch Avengers and it's just this fucking thing happening in front of you that you can only witness it. And so I think, you know, porn and horror movies to some extent as well, which are also much beleaguered art form, they give us those feelings of being transported in and out of the art, like a kind of breathing. So I really appreciate what you're saying.
Well, I think that charge is almost like an existential charge that you get when you're young. We get so many of them because we are opening up to the world. You know, we're coming into our life. And when you get some decades behind you, there is a tendency, an inclination, and maybe even just a natural dulling of the sense. And I think I think that's something that we really have to be mindful of. And it's why I think art to me in many forms is so important, because I think it's the domain, if you like, where the existential charge is still possible. Well, two things. You have to be aware of the dullness creeping in, and it creeps in on all of us. And then you have to go, I think, in search of all of those things. And I again, I'm inclined to say that I think this explosion of fantasy is both a response of, but perhaps also a cause of some dullness. You know, it's like when there wasn't so much stuff around, things emerged in a much more poignant and pointed way. And they were able to have a lot more impact than they do. And it might be why, Connor, things that are technically still regarded as somewhat illicit, you know, the forbidden always has an extra charge to it, even if it's only in your own mind. You know what I mean? It gives it a charge. I don't know. I just think that dullness that Peter was talking about is something that we're suffering from within our society and that the whole kind of experience culture. You know, it's like the 1,000 books you must read, you know, the 100 places you have to go, all those things you've got. It's like driving people towards something that won't give them that charge anyway, because you're operating on somebody. You go, because you're, you know, who the fuck says you have to read that 1,000 books?
Right. And they want to read the list. They don't want to. Yeah. You want to read the list. You don't want to, like, that's why you get the book. It's not to, like, actually go do the thing. Yeah. You wrote something about your therapist telling that, you know, you use self-destruction to deal with difficult situations, like you actually, you know, and I find this so fascinating. Yeah. Self-destruction, and why I'm thinking of it now as you're saying all this is, like, when I was a teenager and a little after that, I was really into punk rock. I went to punk rock shows. I set up punk rock shows. I had a punk rock record label. My friends were in bands. Like, and that encounter with that sort of astral self that was filled with pictures of, you know, emotive pictures all the time and feelings and senses, to the point where I would try to obliterate myself by putting my head up against the speaker and letting the sound run through me, which has not proved to be a wise decision now. I'm 45 with my hearing. But that I got swept up in this thing of, I want to be able to destroy everything, including myself, at any moment and remake it, which has proven to be a truly beautiful tool. It's like the movies where you see the sorcerer turning himself into all these different kinds of animals and all these different kinds of beings constantly in, like, a competition in the Sandman or the Disney's The Sword and the Stone or whatever, or so many Irish Celtic fairy tales. So that constant reforming, breaking down, reforming, that came to me from that open time, that time when I let everything in through those floodgates, especially through punk rock.
Yeah.
So I do think that there's an ego problem there, because punk rock was saying, we can destroy everything, we can smash the system, we can do that. It's like, so the part that's missing from that is, well, what can we create? What can we do? What can we invent and help flourish and thrive and yeah, connect to? However, if we can touch on that openness that we had, and punk rock blew the door open so wide that it's still open to me whenever I want it. And it sounds like it's open to you too, probably as a result of rock and roll in some form, because you have that self-destructive apparatus that you reach for when you need it. Then, yeah, I mean, we can cope and we don't become dulled.
Yeah. I mean, it's not all. I think when my therapist said that to me, it wasn't in the noble pursuit of something. You know, it was.
Yes, I'm undiagnosing you. That's all.
Yeah, self destruction because I didn't want to face difficult things. But that, you know, the other side of that coin, it is that I've resisted for a long time this idea that you have to be fixed. Not like, I don't mean fixed like mended. I mean,
yeah,
cemented in a particular way. And I think I got that as much from David Bowie as anywhere else in the world. I mean, I really do. I think it's sort of where that it was, you know, we speak about transformative things. But I think, you know, when I was, you know, on the road with the band and I came back at the end of the summer and all my friends that were listening to the Eagles and before I left were suddenly all punks, you know, and the lid was taken off. And we were invited to consider that you can just burn that effigy of yourself down and reincarnate, you know, on some level externally. You know what I mean? My friends still secretly listen to the Eagles on the side, but you know what I mean? But they didn't look like Eagles listeners anymore. I don't know if I'm sort of responding to your question. I just think that there is something about, and particularly for me, music as an art form, and I resonate with what you kind of said about your own experience with punk and that self. It's not because it's an interesting. It's not self-hatred. It's not self-negation. It's just this destruction of a figment of your imagination. Anyway, mm-hmm. You know, it's a tool for reinvention. That's how, I mean, that's. I think that was ultimately the real impetus behind at least the initial outpourings of punk in its first incarnation. It wasn't just rage against the world for the sake of raging against the world. It was also a calling out for another, for a different way. I mean, you know, Joe Strummer, you know, true punk is showing kindness to your fellow human being. I mean, you can't, you know, that's how punk do you want to be? Then be that punk. You know what I mean? That's not just a destructive thing. That's actually a sort of constructive way of being in the world, but it requires that you go through this purging, this fire of something.
Self-immolation. I mean, and ultimately, as we get older, the fire doesn't have to come from encountering the passions, but it can actually come from warmth, you know, a sense of love, which is why a lot of theorists and philosophers' work rings so false, because it hasn't actually passed through that fire. It hasn't been warmed by love or kindness. And it's why when we're younger, when we reach for the warmth or kindness, we can't always quite do it yet. So it flares up like a fire. We can't really tend to the fire. We have a bonfire instead of an inner warmth that's in us. And
Well, you know, it's like, you know, you love Ulysses, but, you know, I love that line, you know, what, you know, that when they're in the pub and they hear the shout outside and you know, what's that, you know, it's God, you know, God is the shout in the street. You know what I mean? It's life, you know, cold theory. Yeah.
Which is why you like the Italians.
So. I like that. Yeah, I need some poetry in my theoretical. I don't want to dismiss, you know, the entire, you know, German idealism, but you know, But I'm going, but I'm going to
yeah.
Hegel Schmegel.
So,
oh dear.
Well, there's been no lack of warmth in this conversation, and I'm very happy for that. Thank you so much for being on the show, Peter Biebergall and Barry Taylor.
Really great to be here. Barry, I'm so glad to meet you and have this connection with you today.
Yeah, it was so great. Thanks, Connor, for making this happen. I really appreciated what you've brought to the conversation, Connor, as always. But Peter, it's just fabulous.
Great.
I'm happy to do it. And everybody, thank you so much for listening. Bye now.